Opening the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Tuesday, February 16th, 2010. Please excuse the late start of our meeting today and the absence of committee members. Thank you to Senator Burdick for being here. I know everyone is running a bit late because of a late floor session. I am going to take the bills in the order that they are on the agenda today, but I do need to let everyone know that at approximately 3:20, we are going to have to stand at ease and move to another committee room. I believe that's committee room C. That will happen at 3:20 unless for some reason we are finished with all the business by then. So I'm going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3654A and ask Lori to please give us a summary of this bill.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, House Bill 3654A allows the Department of Consumer and Business Services to waive requirements regarding the ratio of aggregate insurance policies covering obligations upon the request of the mortgage insurer. It outlines the requirements for the department to consider in determining whether the request is reasonable in relation to mortgage insurer's aggregate insured risk and to the adequate to the insurer's financial needs. It states that the granted waiver may not exceed 2 years, subject to waiver and extension not exceeding 2 additional years. It requires the department to review the waiver extension request with the same criteria used in reviewing the initial waiver request. It directs the department to charge a fee for costs incurred in reviewing the waiver request, and it declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact. No statement issued.
Thank you so much. And Pam is bringing the sign-up sheet, and I wonder, and while she's bringing that up, has someone checked to see if Senator George and Senator Girard are on their way? They're on their way. Thank you very much. We have Greg Peden signed up. Come on up, Greg. Welcome. I think if you speak slowly, maybe Senator George and Senator Girard will be here shortly. And also, I know Senator Rosenbaum is just in another committee testifying on a bill and should be here very shortly as well. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Greg Peden, representing the Mortgage Insurance Companies of America, National Trade Association. As Lori very adequately described this bill, this would give the Department of Consumer Business Services some flexibility on this risk-to-capital ratio, which mortgage insurance companies need to comply with under state law. There are provisions of the bill that I think give adequate safeguards to this process, which is that it has a time limit of a maximum of 2 years. The department has a process that's outlined in the bill where an applicant, one of the companies, would have to comply with a review by the department on their financial information and a determination by the department whether or not to adjust the risk-to-capital ratio from a 25-to-1 ratio to something different. The issue at hand here is that there are 6 mortgage insurance companies that underwrite private insurance in this country and here in Oregon. There are currently 3 of them that have notified us that they are at risk in the next year of not being able to meet this 25-to-1 ratio, and so they are asking for the flexibility. The danger in not providing some flexibility here is that they would stop underwriting insurance in Oregon if they couldn't comply with the law. The effect of that, obviously, is people would not be able to get mortgage insurance and then likelihood of not being able to get mortgages. So it would be very damaging to the housing market. This is private insurance. This is not public insurance. This is not Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. And these are insurance policies that are typically underwritten for first-time home buyers or anybody else that cannot typically meet a 20% down payment on the purchase of a home. And so that's the part of the housing market that would be most impacted if we were to have a dynamic where we would not be able to underwrite these policies in Oregon. And so that is the target, that is the purpose of the bill, the flexibility, and I'll stop there and take any questions.
Thank you. I'll start with a question. I know, Greg, you said that this does not exceed 2 years, but it looks like it can be renewed for an additional 2 years.
Yeah. And excuse me.
And if it's renewed for additional 2 years, does the company need to go back to the insurance division to request an additional exception or waiver?
Madam Chair, that is exactly the process that would incur. I think that provides a safeguard for the insurance division to be able to examine what's changed since their first application and whether a second 2-year cycle is warranted or not. And that, of course, would always greatly depend on where we are in the economy.
Thank you. And just for a clarification, I know this is a bill that came out of the House, but this is a bill that the Mortgage Insurance Companies of America have been working on. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Questions for Greg? And I am planning to have Teresa Miller come up to answer a few questions as well, since she's in the room.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator George.
Greg, I appreciate you came by and talked to me, and we discussed something in my office, and I don't think we have time to do it this session, but in future sessions, would your clients be opposed to a sunset on this? I'm a little nervous about allowing insurance companies that are undercapitalized in the long term to be able to use this mechanism. I'd prefer to be able to bring back to a hard line at some time in the future. Is there any problem with next January coming back with a sunset on this provision?
Madam Chair, Senator George, no, there isn't. I think that the intent of this legislation is to get us through a recessionary period. And so there would be a dynamic where I'm not sure exactly what timeline we would be talking about, but there would be a time in the future where this probably wouldn't be necessary. So a sunset might make some sense.
Any other questions for Greg? Thank you very much. And
thank
if
you.
I can ask Teresa Miller to come up. Thank you so much. Do you want to introduce yourself and then any introductory remarks? And then I know that at least I have some questions and the other committee members may as well.
Sure. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I think he covered the basics of what the bill does. I'd be happy to answer any questions about the department's role in this. I would say, I guess, just to start off, that reviewing companies' financial conditions is really what we do at the department. And I would actually argue that it's one of our primary focuses, if not our primary focus, in terms of protecting the insurance buying public. It really is our job to ensure that insurance companies operating in this state have the ability to pay policyholder claims. For much of the work that we do in the financial regulation area, we don't have bright line statutory standards like you see in this bill. Oftentimes, we are applying standards that are used throughout the country by other regulators, which really is why we have professional staff, because a lot of times we're not making cookie-cutter decisions. We're really looking at the individual circumstances facing a company and making a decision about how best to protect policyholders. So, with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Well, you anticipated my question because I was going to ask for some assurance that consumers will not be put at risk, and I know that a lot of work went into crafting the bill to give you the tools you need to make a good determination about the soundness of the company. So I think you've answered my question. Are there other questions? Senator Gerard.
Yeah, the question I would have would be one of fairness. So if I read the bill, it says may waive. Now, it seems to me like if I'm just trying to figure out why one company might be treated different than another company, and if so-and-so meets the same criteria, why they wouldn't be waived and one might be waived. It just seems to me like there's going to be a lot of ambiguity, and there might be some calls of favoritism on this.
Madam Chair, I apologize. Senator Gerard, my understanding is that we would be getting requests from companies because they're not able to meet the 25-to-1 risk-to-surplus ratio in statute. The result of not meeting that standard is that companies can't write new business. From our perspective, in reviewing a waiver proposal, we're going to be looking at are policyholders protected, and we're going to be looking at the same criteria for every company that makes that request. And at the end of the day, whether we grant the waiver or not is really just going to depend on whether we believe policyholders will be protected. So I hope that answers your question.
I answered the question.
Senator George?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Teresa, what I'm trying to get at is actually what you brought up in your testimony, which is I'm a little concerned about the fact that we have ambiguous standards that you all apply to companies. So two companies come to you with exactly the same types of financial situations, and your professional staff allows one to operate in Oregon and the other not to operate in Oregon. And that actually does concern me. I mean, when we're talking about regulatory structures, we really want to make sure that everybody's treated the same. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the big things I'm really kind of obsessed with right now is that the unfair application of regulatory structures or administrative rules or agency decisions on companies tends to favor larger companies. And this actually, what you talked about, makes me very concerned. One of the reasons why I like to see a sunset on something like this and then moving towards having more bright lines and less subjectivity out at the agency level on who can actually do business in Oregon. If you could just expand on why you think that I'm wrong on that.
Madam Chair and Senator George, I don't know if there's a particular instance, at least with regard to insurance regulation, that you're concerned about in terms of companies not being treated the same. Just to be clear, this is not my bill. I will absolutely have no heartburn if you choose not to move forward with it. So from my perspective, though, again, our goal is to make sure that policyholders are protected. And we do have a lot of our regulation of insurance company finances is not it's fairly unusual to have these bright line statutory standards. So we do make decisions now just based on let's make sure policyholders are protected. If you're uncomfortable giving us this authority, again, I have no problem if you choose not to move forward with the bill.
I followed real quick. I guess, geez, I actually have no problem with this bill. I actually have problems with the rest of the policy is what I was trying to say. This is that I'm actually more comfortable with bright lines than I am with sort of the subjectivity that's allowed at the agency level, because I'm afraid that there's two companies that could come to you with exactly the same financials, and one is a winner and one is a loser. And that's the kind of things I'm nervous about. And I just kind of want to voice that more than actually make a comment on the bill. So,
and Madam Chair, Senator George, I can certainly appreciate that. I at least in terms of regulation of insurers, I think we have a pretty good track record in Oregon in terms of protecting policyholders. And as I mentioned, financial regulation really is one of the most important things we do. At the end of the day, if an insurance company isn't there to back up their claims and to pay policyholder claims, nothing else we do really matters. So this is something we actually take very seriously. And there are, when I say there aren't often bright line standards, there are standards that are used across the country. And this is something that, particularly with regard to financial regulation, we have accreditation standards that we have to meet at the national level and all states have to meet so that we know we can rely on other states' financial regulation. So it is something that even though there's not sort of cookie-cutter statutory bright lines, it is something that we look at what other states are doing, and we operate very similarly to how other states operate so that we can all rely on our financial regulation of companies.
Thank you, and I appreciate the question, but as I look at all the different things that the director may consider in making this determination, the chances of two companies being equal is, I think, probably extremely slim, if not impossible, because there's so many different factors, and the chances of two different companies lining up, I just don't see happening. So I appreciate your concern, and I'm glad you raised it, Senator George. Any other questions on this bill? No. I'm going to close the public. Anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3654A? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3654A and open a work session on House Bill 3654A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3654A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Bill 3654A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Girard.
Madam Chair, no disrespect, but we've had very little chance to vet these bills, and this committee seems to just ramrod things through. This seems something that I should be in favor of. I'm kind of hesitant because of some language that I find in the bill to be it makes little or no sense. I have to put a lot of reliance on the fact that it was properly vetted in the House. I served on the House committee. I have no such assurances. So I'm really at a loss how to vote on this bill because in this particular topic, especially on these times, I want to help businesses that are struggling a little bit, but on the other hand, I don't want to put a lot of people at risk either. I think we have done that with the bundling of subprime loans at the federal level, and it's easy to make mistakes. So I just am a little bit of a loss, and I'm not sure how I'm going to vote.
I appreciate your concern, and maybe if somebody could go look for Senator Burdick is in the, Lori, if you want to check and see. I can tell you, Senator Gerard, that I appreciate that concern, and as I look back in my file, I've had meetings with Mr. Peden back to October on this issue, and I asked a lot of questions as well, and I know that through the process, since he's been working on the bill, he's worked with the department and has had a lot of meetings and made some changes. There was an amendment made on the House side to address some concerns that has been raised over there. So for what that's worth, I know that there has been a lot of work put into this bill. I also know from the testimony and from conversations that there are several companies that that may be out of compliance, and that would mean that they wouldn't be able to write insurance. And so in this particularly difficult economic time, we want to do what we can to make sure that people can get the insurance they need.
Were there any Republicans that took part in these discussions?
Mr. Peden can come up and answer that question. I don't know. We met at a coffee shop, so he wanted to let me know about the issue. So I don't know who he's met with.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've met with either electronically or in person, have sat down with each of you and given you the background and the material on this. I know, Senator Gerard, you and I were not able to meet, although I certainly attempted to get on your calendar in the last couple of weeks. Maybe a little bit more context here would be helpful and to alleviate your concerns. Number one, Oregon is one of only about six states in the country that has the 25-to-1 risk-to-capital ratio. Most other states have a higher standard, a 30-to-1, a 40-to-1. We set our standard quite a long time ago, about 50 years ago. And as my client has worked this bill around the country over the last few months and working to get some flexibility on each state level that has these type of standards, they've had a great deal of success both in Democratic and Republican-controlled legislatures around the country. You mentioned the bundling of subprime loans and that issue, and this is where this dynamic gets a little bit confusing. These my clients here are private insurance companies who have backed their insurance policies with their own private capital. They are not backed by the federal Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. They're not part of the subprime market. It's really a wholly separate issue held under different regulations and different standards than Freddie Mae or Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. The other part of it is that it's just because a company may not meet the 25-to-1 risk-to-capital ratio does not mean it is a rather arbitrary number. In fact, that it does not mean that the company is likely to go under or subject to not being able to cover its insurance sales. It is rather a number that the state has set on liquidity, and it is because of that, it is a dynamic that is more on the other side, and that is the danger of not being able to underwrite the insurance is where there is a risk to slowing down the housing market even further, not having people who cannot get mortgages and cannot buy homes, first-time home buyers or others, and that's the risk here. I think the process that's in the bill and the financial work that the department will do on an application would determine the financial saleability of a company and would provide some insurances. I think if the department felt like, boy, this company's on the bubble, they would simply say, we're not adjusting this, and therefore, if you can't comply, you're not writing insurance in Oregon, and we're doing that to protect the consumers, and they always have that as a backstop in the bill.
My concern is the ambiguity that goes with the decision-making of DCBS. I don't have a tremendous amount of faith in that organization either. And the problem that I would have is that one company might be favored over another company arbitrarily. Do you share any of those concerns?
Madam Chair, Senator Girod, we don't. There are six companies that make up, that provide mortgage insurance in the country. They, as a trade association, all support this bill. And on behalf of their rather small membership, quite frankly, they think this is the right approach and the right policy. I don't think that's a concern of theirs at all.
Thank you. Okay, we're in work session. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Pam, will you please call the roll?
Aye.
Yeah. It's Girod and I.
Did you call me?
No. I'm waiting for your vote.
I said aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair
George?
Aye.
Chair Bonamici? Aye. House Bill 3654A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any volunteers to carry the bill? Chair will carry the bill. Did you say you would?
I'll do it.
Senator George will carry the bill. I would close the work session on House Bill 3654A and open a public hearing on House Bill 3656A and ask Lori to please summarize the bill for us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3656A provides for the interest in real property covered by a trustee is terminated and foreclosed as to the person given notice of the trustee's sale. It clarifies a prohibition on the action for deficiency on an obligation secured by a residential trustee that is subject to sale or foreclosure. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you. And, colleagues, this bill follows on a similar bill that we heard in the 2009 session, House Bill 3004. It's similar. Some changes were made to that that process, and I think there's a sign-up sheet that Pam is bringing up. Thank you very much. Sybil Hebb and Paul Cosgrove, can you come on up, please? Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Paul Cosgrove representing Oregon Financial Services Association and here on behalf of the United Financial Lobby in support of HB 3656A. As the Chair mentioned, this does follow on a bill from last session. When that bill passed, we found there are a couple of technical changes that needed to be made, actually drafting errors, and this bill incorporates them. And it also clarifies that, backing up just for a moment, the bill prohibits a lender from splitting a loan into several parts, and then with respect to one part of the loan exercising one set of remedies, and with respect to the other part of the loan exercising a different set of remedies. It requires, like a lender who had left the loan in one piece, you exercise one remedy or the other, but not both. And there was some ambiguity in how that was drafted, and 3656 cleans up that ambiguity. So we're in support of the bill as amended in the House and brought to you today.
Thank you very much. Sybil.
Sybil Hebb, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, also in support of House Bill 3656A. And I think we should note this moment when we are
duly noted.
I do appreciate the committee's attention to this issue and do think it will help address a problem that was missed in the bill that was passed last session. And we think it's fair that when loans are negotiated together and packaged together by lenders and their affiliates, that it makes sense that they have one uniform remedy. So we appreciate your attention and support the bill.
Thank you very much. Anyone else here to testify? Oh, questions before you leave. Any questions? No? Anyone else here to testify about House Bill 3656A? No, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3656A and open a work session on House Bill 3656A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3656A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Bill 3656A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Pam, will you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 3656A goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the chair will carry this one. And I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3656A and open the work session on House Bill 3689A and ask Lori to please give us a summary of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3689A prohibits an unlicensed contractor from filing or perfecting a claim of lien against a homeowner's property if the unlicensed contractor participated in performing improvements on the property. Specifies the subcontractor or person providing material, equipment, or labor may not file or perfect a lien if materials, equipment, or labor were provided to an unlicensed contractor. It authorizes the construction contractor's board to notify a person of contractor's license status and to charge for the cost of that notification. It authorizes the board to place a contractor on probation in certain circumstances. It eliminates the ability of a purchaser of residential property to waive protection against a claim of lien. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. There's no revenue impact. Minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued.
Thank you so much. And I have two people signed up to testify about House Bill 3689A. Jeremy, I'm going to try to get it right. Vermilion. Vermilion. I was close. And Craig Smith. And Representative Holvey, who didn't sign up but is here. So come on up. There's three chairs.
That's probably my handwriting. The problem.
Thank you for saving me from embarrassment. Representative Holvey, would you like to start, please?
Thank you, Chair Bonamici and committee members. As you may recall, last session we brought a bill from the House side about the pay-twice lien issue, which ran into a lot of discussion on the Senate side after passing overwhelmingly in the House. And it was at that time that I talked with Mr. Vermilia, and he agreed to help me look at this issue and put together a group from the Oregon State Bar, different sections of that, to look at this issue along with the CCB. And since that time, we have not solved the pay-twice lien issue, but we did take a look at several changes in our lien law that would help prevent those situations from happening in the first place, or at least reduce them to some degree. So I appreciate the work from the State Bar and the CCB and the stakeholder groups that all came together and looked at this bill. We had a work group going on for I don't know how many months, quite a while, maybe since the end of last session, looking at this issue, trying to come up with something everybody could agree to. And certainly we have pared this bill down substantially, so there's a few pieces left in it that I think I would defer to the experts to describe for you. And so it has been a work in progress, and I was going to testify on all the rest of the bills in your committee today, too, but I thought I'd just sit back and watch them pass instead. So I'm taking my chances testifying here. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Holvey. And then we'll take the testimony of, unless you have somewhere else you need to be, we'll take the other testimony. Do you need to go back to a committee or something?
Yeah, I probably do.
Okay. Are there any questions for Representative Holvey before he leaves?
I'm sure there's no place else Representative Holvey would rather be.
Thank you, Representative Holvey. Do you want to decide who's going next? Does it really matter?
I guess I'll go first.
Jeremy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Vermilia. I'm a construction lawyer from Tigard, Oregon, Senator Burdick's district. I appreciate the opportunity to provide some testimony. I would have given you some written testimony, but I only found out about the hearing this morning and was trying to do some work that pays the bills, so I didn't get an opportunity to provide a memo. But I'll give you a little bit of background on the issue and tell you basically the three or four things that the bill does. As Representative Holvey pointed out, there's been a group of attorneys from all sides of the construction bar, as well as some consumer advocate attorneys, who've been meeting. We've met twice, just the lawyers, and then a third time with other stakeholders in the construction industry on this issue in an effort to both look at the pay twice problem and see if there was a way that we could crack that nut in a way that made sense, was workable, but also not do too much damage or tip the bucket, so to speak, with existing lien law. We looked very hard at the idea of a lien recovery fund, which some other states have done. Ultimately, that effort sort of collapsed on itself because of difficulties in administering the program, difficulties in financing the program. We learned that other states' lien funds are, in fact, insolvent, either because they underestimated the number of claims, underestimated the amount of money, or in one case, the legislature raided the fund. When we looked at that issue, it was a question of does the money come out of funds that were otherwise destined for the general fund, or does it come out of surcharges on contractor licenses? Neither of those approaches drew a lot of favor. And so as a result, we took the approach of trying to focus on some narrow and specific areas where we could make a difference where we perceived the problem to be, which is primarily on the remodeling side where lenders are not involved, where title insurance is not involved, where there's not an extra set of eyes, where the purchaser of the product and services are relatively unsophisticated, and see what the law could do to try to protect those people. What we ended up with is essentially a bill that does three things. Number one, we eliminated an exemption in ORS 87007. That statute provides for a number of remedies for new home purchaser, for any home purchaser, one of which has turned out to be a pretty useful tool, which is you get what is called early issue title insurance, and that insurance covers the purchaser from the potential that there would be a lien filed by a subcontractor or a supplier who performed work on that house within 70 days prior to the closing date. And so the ability to purchase that title insurance has essentially protected the owners. The waiver that we are eliminating essentially allowed the seller to have the home purchaser sign a document saying, I waive all my rights and remedies under this statute. We've now eliminated that ability. So anytime a house is sold, the purchaser is entitled to one of the seven items that's in that, I believe it's seven items that's in that statute now. The second thing that the bill does, and probably where most of the teeth is on this, is requires so-called downstream parties, that would be subcontractors and suppliers, to check the license status of the party with whom they're working for or providing services or materials or equipment to at the start of a project. So, for example, a material supplier has a regular subcontractor customer come in and order supplies on account. This would require that the material supplier, at the same time they do what they already have to do, which is provide a notice of right to lien, that they do a license check to make sure that the subcontractor still has an active current contractor's license. It would also require subcontractors to do the same at the beginning of a project whenever they do work for a contractor. And essentially what it means is if you don't check the license status and it turns out that that party was unlicensed at that time, you have lost your lien rights, and you have to be able to demonstrate that you've done that check. So it may be that a week after the beginning of the project, the upstream party lapsed in their license, but you would still, if you can demonstrate that you actually did the check, you'd still protect yourself. It's not going to require an ongoing check throughout the course of a project. The group felt that that would be too burdensome, but there are tools in place already to allow parties to do that at the beginning of a project without too much burden. And then the third thing that the bill does is it sets up a limitation on a probationary status, would allow the CCB to issue a requirement to a contractor that overcharges or doesn't perform work pursuant to a large upfront deposit, would allow the CCB then to require that contractor to charge no more than and I can't remember what the exact amounts are. I believe it's 50% if you're over $100,000 and less if you're under $100,000. I may have those percentages backwards. But in any event, provides the CCB with some tools to regulate behavior of contractors who've gotten themselves into situations where they charge a large upfront deposit and then don't perform the contract, which we've heard that is a significant part of the problems that we were looking at. With that, I'm going to conclude my testimony and let Mr. Smith testify unless any members of the committee have questions.
Thank you so much. I think we'll hear from Mr. Smith and then open it up for questions. Welcome back.
Senator Bonham, Chief Members of the Committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. I can't add a whole lot to what Jeremy has provided. I think I want to use a little bit of time just to publicly state to Jeremy how pleased we are to work with him. And he's really a member of some of those young gun lawyers who are coming up, I think, in private enterprise. And for free, he's adding to our work, and not adding to our work, but helping us do our work and doing a heck of a job. And again, I sincerely want to thank him for that. There are three issues here before you in this bill. One of them has to do with new construction. Jeremy talked a little bit about it. That's that bill from four or five sessions ago that had to do with protecting new home buyers. This bill would eliminate the provision that sellers now can agree with buyers to just waive those protections. This would eliminate that and require the parties to enter into some kind of meaningful protection for consumers. Secondly, in remodel or renovation, there would be some additional burdens put on subs and suppliers to check licenses to make sure they're selling to licensed contractors or they would lose their lien rights. And lastly, this probation issue would allow the Contractors Board to put some contractors on probation if they charged a 50% or more down payment and then either didn't do the work at all and failed to return the deposit or failed to diligently perform the work. And from a probation standpoint, we're talking about having the contractor come in, talking to them a little bit about their business practices, perhaps putting them on a short leash and suggesting that they show us some of their contracts in the future, that sort of thing. That's the bill in summary, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'm going to open it up to questions, but I wonder if either of you could please talk a little bit about who was involved in the work group and to make sure that all the interests were considered.
I think it'd be best to have Jeremy talk about that. I wasn't involved in those.
And I see Scott Berry. Are you planning to testify on this?
I'm certainly happy to come up if you'd like me to.
Why don't you come up if you want to come up and say a few words?
Do we have to?
Do we have to? My vice chair wants to know, do we have to?
Madam Chair, with respect to who was involved in the initial work groups, I'm not going to be able to recite to you all the names, but initially, the way this kind of came down, I sort of volunteered the construction law section of the bar to assist Representative Holvey in this, and so there were three designees specifically from the construction law section executive committee, myself, Alan Mitchell, who is a lien law specialist, and Darren Loisel of Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt. Also involved was Eric Grassberger, who I think you're familiar with at Stoll Reeves, and his associate, Sean Gay, was involved as well. There was a bankruptcy lawyer whose name is escaping me now, who was sort of a consumer advocate, and there were, if I recall correctly, there were about two or three other lawyers, as well as a title insurance specialist who was involved throughout the process. We also had Kathleen Dahlin and Mr. Smith from the CCB involved in it. So we had a pretty good cross-section of general contractor, owners, reps, consumer advocates, folks from the title side, and the CCB. It was a pretty good working group. And then we had a third meeting where there were other stakeholders involved. The Associated General Contractors was there. Mr. Berry was there. We had representatives from subcontractor groups, and the title insurance folks and a number of others. I would say there was a good 25 or 30 people by the time we got to the third meeting. So we had a pretty thorough vetting of these of the issues that are in the bill.
Thank you. Scott, you want to?
Good afternoon. Yes, Scott Berry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association. I just wanted to say that I'm just happy that once the attorneys were done creating the bill, the other stakeholder groups were able to get in there and make all the corrections necessary to get good legislation passed. But I do want to thank, actually, Mr. Villamilia for all the work he's put in. He's put in quite a bit of work, and it's been a lot of effort, and I do want to thank him for all the work on this final product.
Thanks for the lawyer joke.
And I see AGC in the room. Do you feel the need? Thumbs up? Okay. Just want to make sure we get everybody's perspective. Questions? Senator Gerard.
Well, the question I would have and the concerns I would have, just and since I've only had a very short time to kind of go over what's on this, is the supplier. The person that furnishes the timber. Now, you said that you need to check his credentials or his licensing for the project. I don't see anywhere in here that project is defined. Are we talking 120 houses, and halfway through he had a problem, and therefore the other houses don't count? Individual home? Or what defines the word project as what you gave?
Well, I'm going to answer part of that question, Senator Girard, and then I'm going to look to Craig to see if he's getting technical input on that. With respect to the suppliers, we actually spoke at length with several attorneys representing suppliers who were not involved in the work group but who primarily represent suppliers. Doug Hookland from Scott Hookland, which is a law firm that represents almost exclusively suppliers, had some input into this. And I've also spoken to a number of both equipment and material suppliers about their current practices. And they basically agreed to sort of hold their nose and go along with the bill. And part of the reason for that is that Washington, and I believe Idaho, already have provisions similar to this where on a project-by-project basis you have to check the license status. And the way that we envision kind of defining the parameters of that is similar. And the reason this works is because it aligns with when the supplier must already, in law, issue a notice of right to lien. Every time a new project, a subcontractor comes in with a new project, there's a new account or a new file number or what have you set up, because the supplier is not entitled to record a lien unless at the beginning of each project they issue a notice of right to lien. So they already have to go through a process to identify when a new project starts and when a new project finishes, or when a project finishes, so that they can assure themselves of having their lien rights. This is basically just one more step in that process that they already go through. So with respect to how we define project, I'll let Mr. Smith address that, but that practice is already essentially in place.
Madam Chair and Senator Girard, I there's not a lot I could add to what Jeremy has indicated. This is not in CCB law. This is in lien law. And I think the key that I picked up from Jeremy's explanation was that this is parallel with the current notice requirements. They already have to determine what the project is in order to maintain their lien rights. And although there's been no case law yet, I would project that there's a good chance that the word project is not as ambiguous as it may sound. That's already pretty well known in the industry, although I don't practice in that on an everyday basis.
Questions? Further questions?
So, Madam Chair, I had
Senator Rosenbaum.
Just a general question, and because this area of the law is not an area of expertise for me, and it is complicated, but is it the case that the practice of general contractors not paying their subs has been really primarily limited to unlicensed contractors, and that's why the provisions of the bill mostly deal with unlicensed contractors? Or do you feel like there are other remedies for licensed contractors so that just you already have sufficient protection in those cases?
Senator Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, there's a couple of things. Number one, as we went through this work session, process, what we in with a lot of assistance from the CCB and sort of ferreting out what kinds of claims around this issue they have gotten, what we were able to glean was the majority of the problems in this pay-twice area have to do with remodeling construction, and so that's why the bill is really focused on remodeling. That's number one. Number two, with respect to the licensing issue, the requirement that you check the licensing status and you kind of keep an eye on who you're doing business with, and the limitations on deposits are geared towards sort of providing deterrence, essentially, for ensuring that you're dealing with parties and contractors who understand the law, have had to go through the licensing examination, who have a better understanding of what the law requires in contracts, et cetera. It doesn't go as far as some would have liked it to have gone in terms of, we had at one point what we were dealing with last year was changing our lien system from a direct lien state to a derivative lien state, which essentially changes the burden from the homeowner and in terms of protecting their own rights to subcontractors and suppliers. The work group, all of the stakeholders essentially agreed that that wasn't a place we wanted to go at this point in time. We wanted to try some less dramatic changes to the law with respect to kind of nibbling around the edges and trying to guide behavior. So I guess the short answer to your question is it doesn't go as far as I think where you're kind of going with the question. It doesn't say, simply if you've had to pay twice, the person who provided the materials and supplies doesn't get to lien. It doesn't do that. But it does, I think, provide a measure of protection against unlicensed contractors in an area where I think the anecdotal evidence suggests the majority of problems related to unlicensed contractors lies.
Let me just take a quick stab at that as well and just remind the committee that about 7 years ago, a bill was passed that required new construction for new homes to be covered by one of the options that was already touched on in this bill. The majority, I would say 90%+, are covered by the early issue title insurance, which means a lien can't be perfected that the homeowner would then have to pay. There's insurance provided to take care of that lien. So it's not an issue on new construction. It also talked about certain remodel projects that were put up for sale. That's why the specific focus of this bill was on those remodel projects that potentially would leave a homeowner in a twice-pay situation.
And, Madam Chair, if I can chime in, if I heard the question right, it was why are you picking on unlicensed contractors? What is the distinction? Do they cause more problems than the licensed contractors? And if that's the question, I think the answer would be there's a higher risk for them. With material dealers, if they sell to a non-licensed contractor and still have lien rights, there's no real incentive for them to monitor and only sell to contractors who are legitimate. This provides a disincentive for material dealers or others to sell goods or services to unlicensed contractors, which reduces the risk. Licensed contractors, of course, provide that bond. That bond can pay those material bills rather than have it be a pass-through to the consumer. So by putting a little bit of a burden on the material dealer or others to check to make sure the contractor is licensed, you may end up with less of these pay-twice situations.
And thank you. Just to clarify, I would never say why are you picking on unlicensed contractors when they're not following the law. We would not be picking on them. We would be just asking them to do what we would of anyone else doing business in the state and follow the law. So
thank you for the clarification. Any other questions? Is there anyone else here to testify about House Bill 3689A? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3689A and open a work session on House Bill 3689A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3689A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Bill 3689A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Gerard.
Madam Chair, I will be a no on this. And this is extremely complex stuff. You could spend tens and hundreds of hours on this stuff. And we're pushing it through in, about 10 minutes. And I watch NCIS, and they always talk about gut feeling. I do not have a good gut feeling about this. I'm voting no.
Senator George?
I'm going to support the bill, but it does sound like a bit of a conspiracy to go against anybody who is trying to start up a small little business in these rough times. I can get him to build a fence for me or do something else like that. And just kind of the attitude about people who, at this time, this economic time, may not comply with every aspect of the law, we're going to exclude them, kind of made me a little nervous. That last conversation made me incredibly nervous about how we approach things. The fact is that going through all the regulatory hoops to get licensed, for some people who just need to get work now and they know how to be a carpenter and they can do some work for me, I really don't have a problem with people being innovative and trying new things. It made me a little nervous about the idea that we're going to try to clamp down on people who maybe may do a fence for their neighbor or do a a quick wall or something in somebody's house, I really think that we need to be careful when we use regulatory structures like that. And so I will support the bill, but that kind of conversation made me incredibly nervous.
I appreciate the comment, Senator George. I think that that's something that would be covered by another bill that you may have in the future to change certain definitions, but certainly isn't covered by this bill. I wanted to make a comment about the process. I know that the former bill that dealt with the pay twice lien situation saw a lot of work in the House, and then when it came over here, there were issues that were identified that caused it to not go forward. And so I really appreciate all of the parties getting together over the interim and spending so much time to address what Senator Gerard is correct. This is a complicated issue, but I'm confident from what we've heard today and from the process that enough concerns have been addressed that this is a bill that I'm completely comfortable moving forward in light of the testimony we heard and the amount of work that's been put into it. And I especially appreciate the preventive approach because I can see a lot of benefit that comes from preventing problems from happening at the outset rather than dealing with them after the fact. So pleased to support this bill today. Any further discussion? If not, Pam, will you please call the roll?
Senator Burry.
Aye.
Senator Broad.
No.
Senator
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3689A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I was going to ask Senator Gerard to carry the bill, but I don't think that's going to work.
You do it.
I'll volunteer.
No, that's not going to work. Senator Burdick, would you like to carry this bill?
Yep,
Senator Burdick will carry this bill. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3689A. We need to move to another room at 3:20. I think should we begin in here? We can't move yet, right? Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3610, or 3610, and ask Lori to please summarize the bill. And with everybody, if you weren't here at the outset, I need to explain that we need to be out of this room and move to another location at 3:20, so we will be standing at ease while we move. So House Bill 3610, Lori, will you please summarize that for us?
I would be happy to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3610 specifies a date. Trustee must provide an affidavit of compliance with the requirement to meet with grantor and then reviews the grantor's request to modify the mortgage loan. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. There are, however, two, that is on the bill as it is introduced. There are, however, two amendments before you today. The dash fours make the following technical clarifications. It changes shall to must in several provisions. It changes attempting to that attempts to effect in several provisions. It deletes deemed in relation to effective service. It changes on or before the date to at or before the time. That's the dash fours. The dash fives require a beneficiary to disclose before the, that should read for the grantor results of calculation or test required by the federal or state law.
Thank you. And just so everyone's clear on this, we're going to have a public hearing on this today. This bill is not going to move today. Representative Richardson has some constituents he wants to bring to testify about this bill on Thursday. So we are going to have the public hearing today, and then we'll also be hearing this bill on Thursday. So we're going to start with a panel, John Bartholomew, Angela Martin, and Sybil Hebb, please. And just as you're coming forward, I wanted to explain this. Representative Gerard sponsored this bill. I know he worked with Representative Richardson on this, and I believe that Representative Richardson will be making his comments about the bill when he's here on Thursday. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the Senate Consumer Protection and Public Affairs Committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm a policy advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3610, and particularly the Dash 5 amendment that will require lenders to show their work if they deny a homeowner a loan modification and they participate in the federal HAMP program. I presented testimony to this committee last month on this issue, so today I won't revisit all of that except for a few updates on why this is even more important today. In that testimony, I noted the increasing rate of foreclosures in Oregon, and just last week, RealtyTrack released new data that showed that for the full year of 2009, foreclosures in Oregon were up by 90% since 2008 and up 303% since 2007. And numerous analysts are still saying that foreclosures won't peak until late this year or early next year. We really are in a crisis situation. And this crisis is hurting our overall economy, hurting communities, and, of course, hurting individual families. Last month, I presented several stories to you from homeowners facing foreclosure. I've spoken to over 20 families all across the state who are trying to get loan modifications, and, of course, they're just a small sampling of the thousands of people who are fighting for this all across the state. Several had hoped to be here today, but because of the short notice, weren't able to attend. So I'm going to give a little bit of an update on just one of the stories. Lisa Gates from Portland was here in January for the previous hearing. She had been told on October 1st last year that she had been approved for a loan modification by her lender, which was Wells Fargo. She was given terms that she could agree to and so that she could stay in her home. However, she didn't receive any documents to sign from Wells Fargo, so when she called back a short time later, she was told she wasn't eligible for a loan modification and wasn't told why. But she persisted. She plugged away at trying to get a loan mod through Wells Fargo and was told again that she was eligible. So she proceeded with providing them all the information they requested. The day after our hearing in January, she got a letter from Wells Fargo saying that she had been denied for a loan modification. And actually, she shared that letter with me. The reason they gave is, we were unable to get you a revised payment amount that you could afford per the investor guidelines on your mortgage. That's all they were willing to tell her. She requested more information as to, well, what are the investor guidelines on my mortgage? What numbers did you use? And they refused to tell her. There's multiple websites, including HAMP's website, the federal one, that determine, that, you know, help you calculate if you're at least in the ballpark of eligibility. And these websites said that she would qualify for this. She has income. She has a job. She was just looking for a slightly lower rate for her to be able to continue making her payments. She really is the classic candidate for HAMP loan modification, yet Wells Fargo denied her. So she wrote a letter to Wells Fargo asking why, and they refused. Then she went to the Better Business Bureau and filed a complaint. Wells Fargo has since agreed to reconsider her request. The fact that they are reconsidering her request makes me wonder if they actually did make an error the first time they denied her the loan modification. However, they have still refused to let her see the calculations that they are required to do as a HAMP participating lender. Now, if they are making errors, it's important for someone to be able to check and make sure they whether they are or not. Right now, it's like the banks are the kids who say, yes, I did my homework, no, you can't see it, but you have to give me an A on it because I did it right. Except this is not about an A on homework. This is about our economy, our communities, and people being able to stay in the homes that they've been living in for the last 10 years. Showing the calculations that lenders have to do under HAMP will keep the lenders honest, will give homeowners a way to correct errors made by the banks so that they don't lose their homes. With something this important, both parties should have the same information in front of them. So on behalf of Lisa Gates and Charlotte Blobaum in Portland, the Karlowitz family and the Costa family in Bend, Nicole Miles in Springfield, Donna Beck, Nancy Kerber and Sally Carter in the Medford area, and Joanne Smith here in Salem, and the thousands of other Oregonians fighting with their lenders across the state, I urge you to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, John, and we'll hear from probably just one more, and then we'll stand at ease and move. So, Sybil or Angela, did you flip a coin?
No, Angela. Angela. I just begged. For the record, Angela Martin with Our Oregon. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony in support of House Bill 3610 and the Dash 5 amendments. Just a couple of things that I'll add to the testimony we just heard. When Senate Bill 628 went into effect, my organization wanted to connect with homeowners to find out how the law was working for them. So we started a process of actually making phone calls to homeowners who had received foreclosure notices under 628 and conducting interviews to find out how the information was received, were they sending in the form, and how the lenders were responding. The overwhelming response, and we started with a block of about 2,000 homeowners that we contacted, the overwhelming response was one of misinformation, frustration, and a lack of transparency. This is in contrast to the incredible amount of information that homeowners are asked to supply to their lender or their servicer. I submitted paperwork from one such homeowner who was free to share the information. She said, please share this with all the elected officials. I need to let people know the process that I've been going through. As you read through her saga, you see that she has supplied hundreds of pages of detailed financial information. The response that she received from her lender was that the detailed information was not enough to satisfy them, and they now are requesting a certified CPA documentation of her financial statements. This will cost her upwards of $5,000. In the meantime, she has not received information from her lender on what it would take to qualify. This imbalance leaves her in a position to make a very expensive decision, walk away from her home, or spend $5,000 without the information that she needs to know if the CPA assessment turns out the way she believes it will, would she qualify for that modification. Other point I'd like to make before closing my testimony is that this type of change would be in keeping with the adjustments that other states are making in their state foreclosure assistance laws. Just a couple of states I will call out. Nevada, in their foreclosure assistance law, requires the servicers to produce evidence of standing and to produce their loan modification analysis. The Maine law requires that the mediators must be able to see the calculations and the assumptions that the lenders use in basing their modification decisions. And then the other example I bring forward is in Providence, Rhode Island. A foreclosure sale may not proceed unless the lender files certification that several steps have been taken, including that the lender has analyzed the homeowner's request for a modification and provided detailed statements for the reason for rejecting that proposal. So providing that type of detailed information to homeowners is a key feature of programs that are proving successful in other states. We believe it would be an important feature for our program here in Oregon. I'll also just make note to the fact that we are in support of the additional days, the five-day extension for that affidavit. We believe that gives the homeowners an opportunity to assess whether or not the law was complied with. With that, I'll close and say thank you very much.
Thank you. And I know that the 5 days is in that's the underlying bill, not the affidavit, amendment.
Right.
I think this is our cue.
Looks like the revenue
I'm going
committee
to,
is starting to
stand at ease while we relocate to hearing room C.